Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Delighted to have you with us. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. and going to have an interesting show today. We're going to be talking about the range of benefits that are available not only to federal workers, but to military personnel as well. And my guest is General Michael Meese, Brigadier General Michael Meese, retired. He is has a very, very interesting career. And General, I knew your father slightly when he was Attorney General under President Reagan. General Meese, now Michael Meese, he's a PhD among other things, and he's the COO of the American Armed Forces Mutual Aid Association. But General, just as a slow ball pitch, but here, you graduated from West Point, you've got your PhD, and I know you thought there. What happened from graduating from West Point to today, if you can?
Well, thank you very much, Michael. I graduated from West Point in 1981, was actually handed my diploma by President Reagan. And from that point, I was commissioned as a field artillery officer, served in assignments at Fort Ord, California, went to school at Fort Sill, was over in Germany back during the Cold War on what was then the inner German border. Then the Army asked me to come back to teach at the Military Academy at West Point, and so sent me back to graduate school at Princeton for that. After teaching at West Point, I went to a few other Army schools, worked at Fort Hood, Texas, for a while as an artillery operations officer, and then came back because I was getting my PhD to head the economics section at West Point, where we teach all the cadets at West Point both economics, and then later became the department head of the Department of Social Sciences that teaches all the economics and political science to cadets. And it was in that capacity that I got involved in military pay and benefits, as well as had the opportunity to deploy five times to Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan, involved in some of the strategic political military actions there. After 32 years in the Army, I had been having fun the entire time, but there was the right time to retire, and so had a great opportunity to become the Chief Operating Officer of American Armed Forces Mutual Aid Association, what we refer to as AFMA, which is a 136-year-old organization taking care of current military members and veterans, making sure that they have their insurance, wealth management, and other kinds of things well taken care of.
I was in an artillery unit briefly, and one of the things that struck me about the old timers is they always wanted to know where they were. The precision, they made the point, you can't hit something over there if you don't know where you are here.
That's exactly right. It's easier today with GPS,
yeah.
But artillerymen always need to know where they are and where they're firing at.
Yeah, I must say it got old after a while, but I understand it. Your group, among other things, offers long-term care insurance, and wanted to get to that in a minute. But in the column today, of course, we mentioned you're coming on and ask if people to if they had questions. And one of them, and this is sort of the basic question, and it's from John, and he's in Cincinnati, and he says, my question on long-term care insurance: what happens to the money paid into the LTC program over the years, and later the one insured never uses it and passes away? Who keeps the money paid in? The cost for the elderly staying at a skilled nursing home is outrageous, with average costs about $70,000 per year, and now premium rates for the civilian long-term care program are going up. Government should just put an end to this high cost, or a way to reduce costs for the nursing home care and LTC. Now, that's a lot of stuff in there. But
a lot of questions, but John asks a very good question, because it speaks to what long-term care insurance is and how we ought to think about it. Some people, because it has to do with healthcare, think that it's like your healthcare insurance or your dental insurance, where people pay into it and you expect to get costs covered out of it with your costs of medical care, with some deductibles and some copays and that kind of thing. In reality, it's more of a risk management tool, more similar to your automobile insurance or your home insurance. When I go home at night and my house has not burned down, I don't say, shucks, the insurance.
You're not angry.
Yeah. The insurance company kept all that money that they would have used to rebuild my house. Long-term care insurance is a way of a number of people pooling their assets. The insurance company manages that for the low risk but high cost if you get into a long-term care situation where you're requiring care for a long, long period of time.
Well, I frequently tell this story when we get into the subject of long-term care, but I got my long-term care group policy years ago, decades ago, at the Washington Post. And I was technically, for most people, too young to need it. But, it, you know, belt and suspenders, and it was a group plan, and so I got it. I'm so glad I did. At the time, it was offered through a particular company and then to Washington Post employees. At the time, I believe there were 30-some companies that offered long-term care insurance, and now there are about six. Yeah, and the one that I was in, or the one that I am in now, no longer offers it. They had to grandfather us as a group in, but it's so expensive they won't offer it. So I think that answers why the premiums are going up.
No, that's exactly right. Companies who have gotten into the long-term care insurance business have found that it is very expensive. And frankly, we at AFMA looked at potentially getting into long-term care about 10 years ago, but we didn't find a way to make it economically viable, in part because the technology is not on the side of long-term care insurance, because people continue to live longer, there's more life-prolonging needs. And so that's why people look to, and we came up with an alternative that some others have used instead of having long-term care insurance.
Well, you know, talking about life prolonging, there was an obituary either in the Washington Post this week or the New York Times, read them both, but a man had died. He was the last surviving American fighter pilot of World War II. War ended 70 years ago. He was 102 when he died.
Right, and that just speaks to the challenges of making long-term care insurance viable. That's one of the reasons why the long-term care federal program had to raise some of their rates earlier this month. And again, it's still a very valuable program. It still is backed up by well-rated, reputable insurance companies. So people that are participants in the program should not be worried about it. But the costs will likely go up as the probability of the insurance companies having to pay out the costs go up as well.
Right. And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the private sector, in the case of mine, if I had gotten as a standalone policy, single policy, I might have gotten a better premium deal because I was in very good shape, runner, and all that sort of thing. But if not, the group plan is the way to go because the young are supporting the old.
In general, that's true. The key is to look at the details and to find out what potential escalation clauses, what options you happen to have. The federal program is actually the largest group program. 273,000 people are insured as part of LTC Feds, which is a program that was started by Congress in 2000 with the law that was passed in 2000 and is overseen by the Office of Personnel Management. It goes out to be competitively bid about every 7 years.
Okay, and this time around, they raised premiums August 1st, announced it after the fact, but the bottom line is, and in the media, as we do, we look for the bad side, but we emphasize the premium increases, but some of the categories, they actually decreased.
That's right, and people that were already in the program, there was no effect on them. I'm not sure why they announced it in the way that they did, but premium increases based upon actuarially looking at what the costs are to ensure that the overall program remains safe and secure for all those people who have purchased into it. And certainly that's very important for federal employees as well as those in the military.
Right. Now, we're talking about long-term care insurance, and I think a lot of people understand what it basically is. You buy a certain policy, it may cover you for 3 years, 5 years, for life if necessary. There are different levels. There is inflation protection in the more recent ones. Yours sounds a little different. I'm looking at here. It's called, what is it called? Long-term care settlement options.
Right.
As part of a whole life policy. What does that mean?
Right. The difference is that all of these different programs pay for the activities of daily living in the event that you're not able to accomplish those activities, or you require substantial supervision. That's true of long-term care insurance or our long-term care settlement option. The long-term care settlement option that AFMA provides is at no cost part of all of the whole life policies, so that if you have a whole life insurance policy that would say pay $100,000 or $200,000, and you got into a situation where a doctor certified that you cannot accomplish the two of the six daily activities, the same standards as long-term care insurance, then instead of waiting till you die to pay your life insurance policies to your heirs, we would pay that life insurance to you as a settlement option for 50 months, 2% per month. So you still get the same amount, but it just gets paid to you while you're living.
Okay, take a short break here, and we'll come back and deal more with that. I'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Army Brigadier General, retired Michael Meese. He's a PhD, graduate of West Point, and is COO of the American Armed Forces Mutual Aid Association. General, that's a mouthful, but we're talking about long-term care insurance before the break, and you mentioned that you offer it, I guess, in combination with life insurance.
That's correct. We have a long-term care settlement option that is part of all of our whole life policies, so that some people, instead of having long-term care insurance, will purchase the whole life policy, knowing that if need be, they can tap into that whole life policy. Now, it's important to note that the reason why we're able to do that was a decision that was made by Congress that the IRS implements. Normally, you can't get access to your life insurance payment until after you die. But the IRS has said that if you're in a long-term care situation and a doctor certifies that you cannot accomplish two of the six activities of daily living or require substantial supervision, then you can actually access long-term care insurance benefits or a long-term care settlement option up to the maximum daily amount, which right now the IRS has set at $340 a day. And so that means that you can get part of your life insurance policy. And then the IRS also requires, appropriately, that a doctor recertify every year that you still are in those conditions where it is permissible to receive your death benefit essentially tax-free during your lifetime.
And you mentioned something before the break, I think, about when you draw down your life insurance money, when it's 2% a year, is that correct?
Yeah, no, it's 2% per month.
I'm sorry.
For 50 months.
Okay.
So you'd get the entire 100%. So, and consequently, that would be something that would supplement your income. You could spend it for those home nursing care, for an assisted living facility, or to defray part of the cost of nursing homes. And many of our members use that. In some cases, we pay that benefit directly to the nursing home to be able to take care of them.
Okay, whenever we talk about long-term care insurance on the show, I guess it's good to use examples. My mother, a longtime government worker, and she had she did not get the federal long-term care program, but she did get one from the outside. And she was retired and in good health until the last year or so there. And the fact that she had long-term care insurance, Social Security, the federal health plan, and her retirement annuity, she stayed in the best possible facility. She hated it because it was full of old people, but that happens. But she stayed in the best kind of facility, and for me, her only child, it was a financial cushion.
Yeah, I think that that's important. The key is long-term care insurance may not be the best option. Long-term care settlement option may not be the best option, but everybody, especially when they're in their 50s, or certainly by the time they're in their early 60s, should have a long-term care plan of who is going to take care of them when they, in the event that they get into a situation where they need somebody to take care of them.
And who do you not want to burden with this?
That's
your
right.
Your kids, yeah.
In most cases, it's family caregivers provide twice as much support for long-term care than all of the paid long-term care providers combined. And so it's normally spouses or children that take care of individuals. And that's what each of us needs to figure out is, where are our children? Where are we going to be? What are those potential expenses? And then what's the best way to provide for that long-term care?
A friend of mine said it's a lifetime Christmas gift to your children or some of your relatives. It helps them, and I've experienced that firsthand.
That's right. People need to think about whether they're going to rely on their family, whether they're going to do it out of their own savings, whether they're going to use long-term care insurance, or potentially from either us or anybody else, a long-term care settlement option linked with a whole life policy.
Now, General, I believe the federal long-term care program run by OPM,
right,
privately financed, but run by OPM, now, that's open to the military, is it not?
It is. It's open to anybody who's currently in the military, as well as any retiree, to include reservists who are retired. They call gray area retirees, mm-hmm, even before you've gotten in. So, and to be honest with you, I did not know that when I was in the Army. It wasn't until I retired and took this job at AFMA that I learned of that. So for those that are in the military out there, it's an important thing for them to consider, because it is one of the best programs. I think less than 10% of those that are in the federal long-term care program happen to be in the military.
Yeah, and in my case, I was just in, but I didn't retire anything. I would not be eligible for it.
That's correct, unless we recalled you to active duty,
okay,
Mike.
Which, I dream about that sometimes. I really do. Well, good. General, turning to something else.
Sure.
Kind of unavoidable. It's been in the news lately, and with the caveat that my son-in-law, Rick Hicks, Frederick Hicks, in Richmond, is a former Army Ranger, and he jumped into Panama in December of whenever it was, 86, 37. So I know a little bit about Army Rangers, the best of the best. You were an Army Ranger.
I was in the Army. I was not a Ranger.
Okay. They've now, two women have apparently passed the grueling training, and I think I saw last night on television that the starting class was 400. By 3 days, it was down in half,
right,
and I believe 93 of 400 graduated. Two of them are women. This is a first.
It is. In fact, they'll graduate on Friday down at Fort Benning, Georgia, and it's going to be a great day for them and for all of their classmates who graduate. In my case, I happen to have my son-in-law graduated from Ranger School in April. He, like these women Rangers, took a couple of extra recycles in order to be able to graduate, so that's not uncommon. But I think it'll be a significant day for the Army, and it's certainly a significant day for this lieutenant and captain, both happen to be West Point graduates, who will be graduating on Friday.
And to your knowledge, did they in any way, and I know they were recycled, and that happens in basic training too, but were the standards lowered at all for them?
As far as I know, and actually there's a very good man that's the commander of the Ranger Training Regiment, Colonel Dave Fivecoat. I talked to him when I was down there in April, and his charge and what he was doing was ensuring that the standards were not any higher and not any lower for the women to be able to graduate. And as far as I can see from all of the press reports and everything that I heard from folks that are down there, that's exactly what they tried to do and what they accomplished. So I think that these women can be very proud of their accomplishment, as all of their male classmates are. And the Army and the nation, frankly, can be very proud of what's happening.
Well, I know all of these elite units, the SEALs get most of the publicity for a variety of reasons, but there's Delta Force that nobody hears about. Pretty good outfit. Air Force Recon, Marine Recon, of course, Army Rangers, Green Berets. But I was at my son-in-law's a wedding rehearsal dinner, and this sounds very fancy, but it was about 30 people in a restaurant in Alexandria, Virginia. And we were there with a lot of his Ranger buddies, and sitting over in the corner was a guy with a Ranger t-shirt or a Ranger hat on, and they all saw him, got up, walked over, sat down around him, and I thought, what's going on here? And they seemed to chat for a minute and all shook hands and came back. And I said, what was that all about? And he said, well, if we see somebody with a Ranger equipment or tab or something like that, we go over, and he's supposed to present a challenge coin, I think, to show it. If he doesn't, he has to do 20 push-ups, and there's other challenges. And I said, well, what if you find out he's a fraud? And he said, well, we throw him out the nearest window. And I said, but we're on the third floor. And he said, that's right. So very proud for them to make this. And
I think it's great. And again, it speaks to leveraging all of the assets of the Army and all of our military to make the military as good as it can be. And that includes the most talented women, the most talented men, and we should all be very proud of that as citizens.
And the next issue is whether they will actually be deployed to combat or not.
Women have always been deployed to combat, uh-huh. Especially recently. By the beginning of 2016, Secretary of Defense Carter has to make a decision on what units to exclude from integrating women into, and each of the services is reviewing those. For example, most of the positions in field artillery were recently opened. Each of the people in the military chain of command are now reviewing that. That'll go up to the Secretary of Defense, and he'll make a decision if there should be any units that continue to be excluded from being open to women.
We need to take a short break here, talking with General Michael Meese. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM.
Great.
And Mike Causey, welcome back. I'm talking with General Michael Meese. He's retired Army Brigadier General and now with one of the longest titles I think I've seen in a while, American Armed Forces Mutual Aid Association. And Lauren Larson, our producer, found you guys and persuaded you to come on the show. This sounds like a relatively new organization just by the name American Armed Forces Mutual Aid Association.
Yeah, actually, it's an old organization. Originally, it was the Army Mutual Aid Association, founded in 1879, and it's an interesting story. Back on the plains of the Old West, when somebody died, the way that they would take care of the widow was they would pass the hat, and that's where the tradition of passing the hat came in. People would put some money in there, and that would be sent back to take care of the widow. Well, when the 7th Cavalry was wiped out at the Battle of Little Bighorn under Colonel Custer,
1876.
At the time, 1876, yeah. The okay. Army said, this program of passing the hat isn't going to work.
Yeah.
So they turned to the Assistant Inspector General of the Army at the time, Roger Jones, who was a lieutenant colonel. They formed a committee including Philip Sheridan, Arthur MacArthur, and Abner Doubleday.
Oh,
and they founded this organization called the Army Mutual Aid Association to exclusively provide for the swift, substantial, and compassionate benefits for members of the military. Shortly after that, the Navy Mutual Aid Association was founded, and for the last 136 years, we have been taking care of the insurance needs and now the financial planning and benefits needs for survivors of those who have died. Again, we can only take care of those that are or were in the military, but that's what we focus on.
You know, we are a new country, but we do have a history. And when you said Abner Doubleday, my producer, Lauren Larson, I can see her. She's still swooning. She is a big-time baseball fan, covers it. And she recently made my grandson very happy. She snagged him a Bryce Harper Chia Pet at one of those games. So her stock is riding high. But Abner Doubleday, the inventor of baseball,
by most reports.
And you said Arthur MacArthur. Would that be General Douglas MacArthur's father?
That was General MacArthur's father.
So he won the, or was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor in Georgia, Stone Mountain. Amazing. And who was the other person?
And the other was Philip Sheridan, the Civil War
we know
general,
him.
Of course.
The Shenandoah Valley hasn't forgotten him. That's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and so what we have done since then is been able to continue to take care of folks. What's interesting is although we are a 501c company association, we don't take any contributions. It is military people taking care of other military people. And as a result, over the just since 9/11, we've been able to provide to military families over $550 million in death benefits to ensure that military families are well taken care of when their service member passes.
Well, and that's where the term passing the hat came from. And
that's exactly right.
And the Custer Massacre, of course, I think they lost more troopers that day than they did in the rest of the Indian Wars combined, correct?
I think so.
Yeah, amazing yeah. thing. Well, now, the theme of my column today, the Federal Report, is that most of us, back in the day, not that long ago, we all knew somebody in service. Many of us were in it because of the draft, but we had a brother, a cousin, a sister, a father, a grandfather, an uncle who had been in service. Not so much anymore. And that it shows sadly, you know, we salute soldiers at baseball games and we honor them, but kind of from afar. We don't know much about them. And a lot of the people going into the military today, I assume, because they're talking about recruiting levels are down, partly because the economy's improving, but these are young men and women, for the most part, very young men and women. They're not thinking about retirement. They're not thinking about anything. We were all 18. We were all 19. If somebody had offered me a 401k plan, I'd have said, no, thank you. I don't eat candy. You know, what should they be doing? What can we be doing if there's a military member in our family?
No, I think you're exactly right, Mike. When I came into the Army, all of my male role models, my coaches, my teachers, they were all in the military. Now less than 1% are serving in the military. And so consequently, the military works hard at financial readiness training to be able to help young soldiers think a little bit further. You may have seen the recent proposals by the military compensation reform and retirement modernization committee that propose automatically putting 1% into a TSP program, similar with the same federal program as the TSP, and then being able to automatically enroll even young enlisted soldiers or young officers in at the 3% level with a federal matching of that 3% up to 5%. And that would start to get people that are even 19 or 20 or 21 years old into thinking about their retirement and thinking about their financial planning a bit earlier than they otherwise might.
Well, you know, I think it's unconscionable, and I understand the cost factor, and I understand you and I and others would be paying for it. But that said, I don't see why they don't give the military the same match that they do people under the FERS retirement program. Again, I know it's a cost, but it seems to me that would be an incentive, the potential for a tax-deferred 5% pay raise as long as you were in.
Yeah, and that's this proposal from the Retirement Reform Committee was to provide that match of 5%. At the same time, the overall defined benefit program that currently exists would be somewhat less generous than it previously would. So net-net, it would probably come out to be close to budget neutral.
So that's kind of like the FERS retirement program for federal workers, and it's what many, if not most, private sector companies are doing now. They're switching more of the burden to the employee, in this case, the military person.
That's right. The federal the military retirement really has not fundamentally been reformed substantially since World War II. This would start to begin to change it from entirely a defined benefit plan to having a partial defined contribution plan component. And that's particularly important for those service members that do not stay for a 20-year retirement, but then leave and go to some other job, which may make the military more attractive to others because they can also build up equity for their own retirement.
Yeah. Well, you're an interesting person to talk to about this. I was Googling, just looking you up last night, and I saw a white paper, if that's the correct term, that you had delivered at West Point, and it was about the military drawing down, and you were saying we're going to have to pay more attention to and spend more money, fewer people, but we're going to have to be more people-oriented.
That's right. As General Dempsey mentioned last week, we are approaching the smallest army that it has ever been in my lifetime. So that's why it is even more important that the quality of those soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines that are in our military are as good as they possibly can be.
I've heard this anecdotally, and I assume it's true, I've heard it so often, is that in 1939, when Germany invaded Poland, we didn't get into a little bit later, but in 1939, the United States had the 19th largest army in the world. We were on a par with Portugal.
Yeah, that sounds like that's about right. Not necessarily the exact year. And we're about to get to the level that we were at about on the 7th of December 1941. And that's out of a nation that now is 300 million compared to the nation of 100 million or so during World War II.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, and you know, after World War II, we had something like 14 million men and women under arms. And by the time Korea came along 5 years later, we were not ready.
Right. And that's the challenge is for the military, especially in a much more threatening and much more uncertain, complex world that we face, is to always be ready for all those eventualities.
Back to the long-term care thing. I was thinking, when I got it, I was relatively a child in long-term care terms. And but I did get a good rate as a result of that, and I was in really good shape. But I wasn't thinking about a illness. You know, at that age, you're invincible. Right. Nothing could harm me. But I was well aware, because I walked to work every day, that I could easily step in front of a bus or fall out of a window or something. And that's as much a reason, I would assume, for long-term care as an illness.
That's right. And that's why both life insurance is important, well as some option to be able to take care of long-term care, whether that's long-term care or part of a life insurance plan.
Need to take another break here, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you the difference and the age cutoff, if any, between long-term care and long-term disability insurance.
Got it.
Be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. We're in the final phase of the show, talking with retired Army General Michael Meese about all manner of things. And General, before the break, I asked you for the distinction between long-term disability and long-term care. We've gone through long-term care, pretty well understand it. But I've heard people say there is a cutoff. There's a certain age, up to a certain age, when you need disability insurance and then long-term care.
Right.
Is king.
Probably in the ages from the 20s to your early 50s, potential long-term care disability insurance, that replaces your wages in the event that you get hit by a bus walking to work, so to speak, and replaces income that you might otherwise lose and be dependent upon. The long-term care insurance is providing you income to take care of the activities of daily living. Again, that is mostly more applicable when people purchase it when they're in their 50s, and it's usually used by those that are over 70 or over 80. So they are both ways of mitigating risk by paying a premium and sharing that risk with others. But you're more likely to need the disability insurance when you're younger, and the long-term care either insurance or a settlement option when you're older.
Right, and your income is higher too.
That's exactly right. Okay. And hopefully you've saved up money throughout a lifetime so that you've got some way to cover some of that yourself.
Our producer, Lauren Larson, has an idea. She said, why don't you guys talk about the financial planning needs of young people in the military? Because by definition, they're young when they come in. Teenagers, many of them. A 23-year-old is the old man of the outfit. At that age, most of us don't have a particular financial plan in mind.
Right, and frequently they're a long ways from home, and so they don't have parents that would normally guide them on these sorts of things. And so when we talk to our members with AFMA and others, we really tell them that your finances should be three legs of a stool. The first is the budget, to make sure that you are living within your means. And because you're somebody in the military, you frequently will have a lot of credit card companies and others helping you spend your money. And it's pretty easy to get into debt because you have this fixed income and this check coming in from the military. So that's something to be very cautious and live within your means. The second part of it is to manage your risk. And that's where insurance comes in, whether it's life insurance through AFMA, through the federal SGLI program or others. Eventually that becomes managing it through disability insurance possibly, or long-term care insurance. And then the third aspect is investments. The investments should start out as participating in the TSP program, for example, for anybody that's in the military, as well as federal employees. And if you can orchestrate those three legs of the stool, first, budgeting, second, managing your risks, usually through insurance or other methods, and then finally, investments, that is a good preparation for everybody, especially those who are in the military.
And with the Thrift Savings Plan, for people who just tuning in who don't know the government, that's Uncle Sam's 401k. Open to the civilian side, obviously open to the military, huge participation. The civilians who are in the majority retirement system, FERS, get a match of up to 5% in their accounts. The military don't get that now. And as you said, they're working toward it, working to integrating them in it. But for the military, this is perfect. You're young, you come in, before you've even seen a paycheck, you allocate 1-2% of it to the TSP, they match it, hopefully someday, and by the time you're ready to leave and go into the civilian world, you have a nest egg that's tax-deferred and portable, correct?
That's correct. The TSP program is one that we encourage folks that are in the military to consider because it has a very low cost cost of management, so that keeping those fees down is very important. It provides a limited but still a pretty good wide range of funds that you can put your money in between the various funds that are offered by TSP. So it is certainly something that we at AFMA consider, mention for all of our members to be able to consider.
Well, I like to use it partly as an advice thing and partly as a name-dropping tool. But a couple of years ago, we interviewed John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard and the godfather of index funds. And he said he'd love to know how to get into the TSP. If there was a way, he'd get in it. He likes its low administrative fees and the simplicity of it. Alan Roth, then of CBS Money Watch, said the exact same thing. He would, if he could find a way, he would get into the TSP in a heartbeat.
Right, and that's something that we, and in addition to providing the insurance, we have a wealth management and financial planning arm at AFMA, and that's one of the things that we do. We don't tell people to roll out entirely out of their TSP unless there's particular circumstances, because it is a great basis for people to start in. Even when you leave it, it's pretty tough to find something that has that low of an expense ratio for many of your financial needs.
It's interesting you say that, because we always keep track of the number of TSP millionaires, and there are a huge number of them now. Some of them did it the old-fashioned way. They went in, plugged ahead, put money and invested in the stock market, rode out the recession. They now have million-dollar accounts. But about half of them brought the money with them from the private sector. So these are, for the large part, they're very smart, very successful lawyers and or doctors who've come in from the private sector with big cash accounts, and they bring their money into the TSP and add to it. And the lure is the low fees.
That's right. And that's something that as you're looking at an overall financial plan is very important to consider.
Okay. General, how can if people want to get in touch with your organization?
If anybody wants to get in touch with us, the easiest way is to go to www.aafmaa.com. And two A's, FMAA.com. Or they can certainly, if you Google us, you should be able to find it. And the 800 number is 800-522-5221. I should mention that we are, by the regulation passed by Congress, only eligible to current and former members of the military, but we're happy to have any of the current or former members of the military or their family members to be able to contact us.
And by former, you mean retired, people like me.
Retired, yeah. And as well as veterans.
Right.
We will include veterans, Mike, could join us, and I'll give you a card after the radio interview today.
All right. I'm looking for a discount, actually. But that would be good. Well, listen, we want to thank you so much for being with us. A fascinating subject. And remind people, our shows are archived here, so every Your Turn show, including today's, will be up, and you can click on it, hit the Listen Live button, and this would be a good one, I think, to recommend to friends and family members. And I'm just, I can see Lauren is still starstruck that you guys date back to General Custer and Abner Doubleday and Arthur MacArthur and General Phil Sheridan.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Mike. We appreciate the opportunity to share this with you.
General, thanks for having us, and we will see you all here next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week. Stay safe.